WCITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya,
and the Skakulia, Tilitin, Homasqueam, Mustayo. Great. Hello, listeners. Welcome to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Dog Eared Radio Book Club. My name is Randy, and I'm the host of this show. So Dog Eared Radio Book Club is a bi-weekly book club where each 2 weeks we read a new book and we talk about it. You can always contact me, the host, on social media, on Instagram at Dog Eared Radio Book Club. You can always email me at dogearedbookclubradio@gmail.com. Please reach out to me with any book suggestions, if you want to be a guest, etc., etc. All right, now let's dive into the show. So today we are talking about the book Our Hideous Progeny by C.E. McGill. And I am joined today by a very special guest, Bex. Welcome to the show.
Hello, hello, beautiful travelers.
How are you today?
You know what? Today has been a whirlwind, but I am so happy to be here.
I am so glad we made this work. Living on opposite sides of the country, it's nice that we can, you know, the beauty of technology that we can be recording this on a random Friday afternoon.
You know what? It's so great. And it's nice to meet another fellow Canadian. So how you doing, eh?
Pretty good. All right.
Right.
All right. So do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure. Okay. So, it's always so funny to just introduce yourself. If you're not used to doing it, it's kind of like, I feel like I'm putting in a resume. So I am someone who's an avid reader, and I am someone who doesn't really have any, I don't have too many, like reader warnings. Like the longer the trigger warning list, the more I want to read it kind of thing. So like I will read just about anything That's out really- there. Right. I do definitely lean a little bit more sci-fi. I do definitely enjoy my own voices genre for sure. And I like the LGBTQ plus reads. Absolutely. The book that we'll be talking about today hit a lot of those points that I just hope to find in reading. On them, because honestly, the book that we'll be discussing today, I literally stumbled upon. It was a friend of mine who shared a reel from Instagram of somebody else who I had never heard of recommending it. And I was like, yeah, sure. You know what? I'll give it a go. And so sometimes those ones that you trip over become your favorites. And that's what I love about reading. I myself, outside of the matrix, I have two little kiddos, and I have a wonderful partner who I share with. My time with and with our littles. And I mean, yeah, we live in Canada, which I'm sure for a lot of listeners, that's not a weird thing, but sometimes when you're logging in online, it's unique to have someone from Canada. So it's cool to have two of us here. I love going outside. I love connecting with nature, usually taking my shoes off, just walking barefoot in the woods, wherever I can, listening to music all the time. You know what? I'm a pretty easygoing person. I definitely am a high functioning introvert where, and then I just need my like days of, okay, I got to just read.
Yeah, that's so fair. I feel like I am also someone who like goes through periods where I'm like, don't talk to me. I just need to read a book. Like, I just need to not have to form a conversation. I want to read a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me teleport or walk through a portal and just hang out with those guys for a bit.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, well, I will share with the audience how I came upon your page on Instagram, because that's how I found you on your Bookstagram account.
Oh, it's so exciting. I don't even know this story.
Well, so I received, when I started this show, which was about a year ago, then in the fall, so a few months into the show, I was just like doing it with my friends and my family. I was forcing my cousins and my aunt to come on the show, which was really fun, don't get me wrong. But I was like, oh, I need more guests. And so Amanda, who has been a guest on the show twice at Cracking.Spines, reached out to me and was like, oh my gosh, I love your show. I love that you're talking about romance novels. And then I was like, hey, you should come on the show. And then kind of from that, I gained some other Bookstagram people. And I'd never been in the Bookstagram space before. I am like a follower on BookTok. And so it kind of just like spiraled. And then I kind of like found these pages and I followed some and then some followed me. And then I was like, you know what? I'm just going to reach out to all these people to see if they want to be guests. And they all responded, which I've never had that before as someone who creates radio content. When you reach out to people, typically it's like one out of six people will respond to you with a yes. So it was so fantastic. But yeah, that's how I found you. So,
oh my gosh, I love this. I love this story. Amanda is an absolute gem of a person. And I haven't been on Bookstagram for too long. I mean, basically it's been one orbit around the sun. I've been about a year. And Amanda Cracking Spines was one of the first accounts that I ever followed, and she was such a warm, welcoming persona. And although, yeah, it's still the internet, there are some genuine people out there, and the Bookstagram community does have a lot of really wonderful souls who spend their time here. And I've honestly made some wonderful connections myself as well.
Yeah, it's really like, I mean, I think Bookstagram has been so much better for this show. Then BookTok is really intense. I find BookTok very overwhelming. I think Bookstagram, I found, yeah, it's like people are so nice and they're so willing to talk about books with people, which is what I love to do.
It's hard to meet people organically nowadays, like out and about. But you know, if you can vibe with someone who likes similar books than you, you already have crossed a barrier in terms of, like, you know, I don't want to call it like moral compass, but sort of along those lines, right? Books, you're probably going to get along well with similar people who read the same books, you know?
Oh yeah, I completely agree with that. That's why I judge people quite harshly on what they like to read, which is, so far it's worked out well for me. I've avoided a lot of I'm trying to think of a very nice word. A lot of men that I wouldn't want to be in my life.
Just avoid the conflict. Exactly. I love that. It's a good litmus test for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. So this book to me spoke volumes about you as a person for recommending this, and then also the author. So I just want to mention very quickly, the author uses they/them pronouns. I believe their name, I was read on their website, is Charlie, but their pen name is C.E. McGill. So they were born in Scotland and raised in the U.S., but then later moved back to Scotland because it's the U.S. And they're all interested in science. And this is their debut novel. And I absolutely love reading debut novels from authors. It's one of my favorite things to do.
You know what? Me too. I've noticed that I have, like, definitely on Bookstagram, whoever's listening, if you're kind of not sure whether or not to take the plunge, it's a wonderful space to learn about independently publishing authors as well. What was so great about C.E. McGill as well that I found was that the idea for this book was originally literally like a paper that they were supposed to write for college. Like this was a project that was supposed to be like 3,000 words, and then it just turned into this huge novel, which, don't we love that? Don't we love that when something snowballs into something so much bigger? Yeah, it's really a beautiful story.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And I can tell that they have that background in science because there were so many parts of this book that went straight over my head, but I didn't even care. Because I was still so into it.
Yeah, you know what? A big disclaimer that I'll make about this book is that it reads in a very smart way, in the way that, like, you take something from it, but it doesn't feel exhaustive. Because there's definitely books out there that can feel very confusing, very convoluted, very intricate. And those are wonderful stories, too. If you're someone who's trying to, increase your reading comprehension level in the sense of being able to follow a storyline, but also read bigger words, read words that maybe you might need to grab the thesaurus for. This is an awesome stepping stone for that, in my opinion, because there's much more complicated books out there. But this book is a standalone. It's not a super big read, but it has really beautiful prose. It's expertly written. Debut, and it was an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, I will agree with you. The prose in this book, I mean, there were so many quotes that I flagged that were just so beautiful, and I have some that I want to talk about later. And I forgot to mention this at the top of the episode, but for the first half of this episode, we will be spoiler free. So normally on the show, I just talk about spoilers all the time because I just like to. But in this episode, we are not talking about spoilers until the second half, and we will definitely warn you when we talk about spoilers. So just listen out for that, but keep listening for now.
Yeah, keep listening. We have lots to tell you.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to talk about beyond like the plot of this book. But yeah, so I actually want to start us off by doing the segment that I normally do in my show, where I read the description of the book, and then we decide whether or not it's accurate. So I'm going to go ahead and do that. As per usual, I have never read this before. I haven't practiced reading it, so it's always a fun time. Because there might be some big words in this.
All right, you can do it.
So here we go. Okay, Thank you.
You have the floor. You got this.
Okay. It is not the monster you must fear, but the monster it makes of men. Mary is the great niece of Victor Frankenstein. She knows her great uncle disappeared under mysterious circumstances in the Arctic, but she doesn't know why or how. The 1850s are a time of discovery, and London is ablaze with the latest scientific theories and debates, especially when a spectacular new exhibition of dinosaur sculptures opens at the Crystal Palace. Mary is keen to make her name in this world of science alongside her genealogist husband, Henry. But despite her sharp mind and sharper tongue, without wealth and connections, their options are limited. When Mary discovers some old family papers that allude to the shocking truth behind her great uncle's past, she thinks she may have found the key to securing her and Henry's professional and financial future. Their quest takes them to the wilds of Scotland, to Henry's intriguing but reclusive sister, Maisie, and to a deadly chase with a rival who is out to steal their secret. Okay, so that's the like general description.
Honestly, say less, you know. We've mentioned dinosaurs, we've mentioned mystery, we've mentioned like historical fiction, we've mentioned like, you know it's going to be a feminist inspired tale. Like, oh, say less.
Yeah, truly. I mean, so then there's this part at the end that's like not part of the like plot description, and it says a queer feminist masterpiece inspired by Mary Shelley's classic Our Hideous Progeny is a scrumptious tale of ambition and obsession, of forbidden love and sabotage, and a twisty gothic adventure that may forever change your view of human nature. Like, that's all I needed. Well, honestly, I didn't even need the plot. So I told you I didn't read it. I fully just read this based off what you told me, which was essentially that it's like a queer reimagining of Frankenstein, and I was like, okay, I'm here for it.
Like, I mean, what more do you need than gothic gaze in dinosaurs?
Like, exactly. Yeah. It's done. Like, you kind of, yeah, you totally know what's going on. So yeah, as for like general thoughts and reaction, I mean, yeah, I think that description is spectacular. Like I said, I would just slap the last paragraph on and call it good. Mm-hmm. But I absolutely love this book because it took me so off guard. So prior to this book, I had only been reading romance, and specifically historical romance. And it was very fascinating to go from like historical romance, which the historical romances that I typically read are like the Hallmark historical romances. So like Victorian is like the setting, but aside from them, like it's very Bridgerton, right? So like there's not actually any of like the bad things in history. It's just like the fun gowns, the fun parties, like the fun society system that like forces them to get married because they were caught alone in the garden. But it's very lighthearted. So to go from that to something like historical fiction like this that does tend to lean into more like realistic portrayals of history was very, like, it caught me off guard, but in a very good way.
It was refreshing in the reality and the humility that is added into it, because I think a big piece to this book is that I suppose somebody, maybe some of the people that you said you wanted to weed out of meeting, might look at this book and see it as, oh, it's a huge, like, angry female main character. Like, she's just going to be mad at everything. And it truly isn't. It is a great example of how, if you can keep your composure in with the historical time period, how your voice can actually be heard where it deserves to be heard in a way. And that's in no way a spoiler. This is simply a very, I think, tactfully handled feminist book.
Yeah, and I think the way it does that is by like staying, like, even though it's science fiction, it's still grounded a lot in reality, which I mm-hmm. found like very satisfying as a reader, that it wasn't, because I personally don't read a lot of science fiction. I think that's because the science fiction that like you know, that you learn about in high school, or you're, God forbid, forced to read in high school, is written by white men. It stars white men. And it tells these very like boring, quest-driven, like high technology type of stories, mm-hmm. which has like never really interested me. So this book, I think, yeah, I know these books exist because, you know, we're having so much push for inclusion and representation in all genres of books. So it was fantastic to pick up something that I kind of shied away from previously.
Well, and I think this book has a lot of things. Like I said, it's going to check off a lot of boxes for a lot of different readerships. And I think that that is a mm-hmm. very smart thing to do for a debut novel as well, just on the like marketing standpoint of C.E. McGill's side, where this is probably unintentional. I can't speak for them, but just to have a time period where it's trendy, you know, like you've got Bridgerton, you've got Pride and Prejudice, you've got all these different time periods that are all, you know, that mid 19th century, or like in the 1800s, setting. So people know what the costume, like what the clothing rather would be. They know kind of, you know, there's no electricity necessarily running through homes. There's, you know, there's not a lot of cars that are running by on the streets. So you kind of know, you don't have to make the world too explanatory to know what's going on there, you know? So I really loved that about this.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's why like the prose gets to be so beautiful, because it's not spending time building a world for you, because it's coming at a point, like you're saying, that like a lot of people can know what this world is. So we're not focused on like, well, what are all the characters wearing at every single time? Because you could kind of just imagine it. Like you get it in your head, you know, you have this picture of like the houses and like the streets. And I mean, because we like, there's so many stories that take place in like London during like the mid 1800s, right? That's right. And yeah, I completely agree. And I think that's why like the author gets to, I think, have so much more freedom with what they're writing.
Well, it's a very character-driven story too, I would argue.
Oh my god!
Because you could take these characters and you could plop them into outer space, and you could still have mm-hmm. a very similar storyline of their personalities, of their characteristics, and it would still be extremely entertaining. I think that the time period is a genius idea as well, but it's also kind of cool because I feel like mid-1800 London, like, you know, been there, done that. We go into Scotland though too, and that's so fun.
True, get something like a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I like your point about how it's character driven, because I wrote a line to how I would describe this book, and I describe this book as being about the villainy of men and women's wrongs, in a good way, you know, mm-hmm. like the good women's wrongs. And so I think it really speaks to like, I mean, like C.E. McGill is like incredibly talented at writing men. Not good men. I don't think that's a spoiler, but
yeah.
Either way, very intriguing men. Intriguing men is the word I'll use.
Well, I think any listener who's going to plop onto C.E. McGill's Instagram page, there's a couple reels that they've posted where it's like, the concept of the book is not what the monster is, but what the monster makes of men, you know? And I think that line is extremely intentional because of partially the time period that it's set in, but also the message there, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, when we dig into the characters, we'll definitely get into get into the monsters. So the one thing I did want to touch on before we get into spoilers after the ad break is the way this book talks about, and I want to give a content warning here, talking about the death of a child shortly after birth as well. So in the book, in the first chapter, we learn that Mary and Henry, the couple, so the book is told in Mary's point of view. So they lost their daughter. I think it was very shortly after she was born, I believe.
It was an hour, yeah.
An hour, yeah. And so this is kind of like a theme that's in Mary's mind as she goes through the book. And yeah, I think that this is like, I mean, it's very difficult to like read and absorb and to think about, but I think it's very important because one thing I learned very young is how much we don't talk about like, either like, I mean, miscarriages, stillborn children, or like children born, like, you know, being sick or dying shortly after childbirth, mm-hmm. that tends to not be something like we view it as kind of like, you know, taboo and like you just don't talk about it because it's like super tragic. And so I think this book, it takes a very honest approach by, first of all, we get Mary's point of view. And it's also, again, real because at this point in time, children were dying a lot. Like mortality rates of children were very high. And so there's a scene like where Mary talks about all of the children that died when she was a kid that she remembers dying. And so, yeah, I'm curious to think of or to ask you how you kind of view that as part of the story, but also how you thought of the representation of that.
Yes, absolutely. So obviously it's a very tender subject. So I will do my utmost to ensure that everything that I say is with respect and love. I myself am a mother and I am not someone who has been able to avoid having these kind of feelings, unfortunately. I have never lost an infant in that way, but miscarriages are absolutely something that has happened in our relationship. And there's nothing other than support, and talking about it is super important. Now, obviously everyone's time when they're ready is their own. I think reading this book as a mother, as a parent, who can quantify what it is to have that, maternal instinct kick in, versus, you know, Bex back in high school reading this book, I wouldn't get the same thing out of it. So, I think that it is handled expertly well in the book specifically. It's a heavy topic, and obviously it's something that weighs heavy as you read it. It isn't, how do I say this? It isn't something that drags the character to a point of destruction, let's say. Like it's not all consuming. Whereas I find sometimes in other reads when this topic is brought up, handled kind of poorly, and it can be like, oh, and this happened. You know, it's not integrated, it's not sewn into who the character is as a person or as a character, right? So I think with Mary's character, it shows a lot of growth, it shows a lot of just tenderness in who she is. And also we see it reflected in Henry as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's done, like when you talk about like sewing it into it, I think the amount of times it comes up and also how it comes up so organically for Mary, like throughout the book, mm-hmm. I think that like adds to it as like, it's part of her character. It's not because we come to her after, I think it's been about a year.
Yeah.
Because they're out of their mourning period for the child, but I can't remember off the top of my head how long the mourning period is.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think like, you know, having, yeah, the way that it comes up so organically, you know, and I think also the other thing I liked is the way that it like dealt with her feelings of guilt and grief over it, but yes. Not in a way that like she just placed overt blame on herself, because when you're talking about books that do it poorly, I think that's a trope that a lot of books fall into, is like a woman, you know, gets depressed after losing a child, but it becomes this very like all-encompassing like individual thing of like, I failed, it's, you know, it's my fault. And I think this book avoids that, but still touches on those feelings, which feel very real. Again, I'm coming from this as like a 23-year-old without children.
That's okay.
I still think it reads like very, I don't know, it felt very honest to Mary's character.
Absolutely. It's a practical use of something that can carry forward the grief that she does feel. Now, Mary, we know from chapter one, is considered like an orphan, right? She doesn't have parents early, and or at least that we don't know of. And so her upbringing comes with a lot of dark pasts. And I think, like you said, like a lot of the historical fiction, probably the romances that you have read previously, are lighthearted and they're fun. And those are wonderful reads. Don't allow me to discount those, because all books are valid. With this, though, it does touch on the little bit of the darkier, murkier time appropriate subjects for sure. And child loss is unfortunately something that has followed the human experience since the beginning. So
yeah,
it is something that was done extremely well, in my opinion, very respectfully. And if that is a personal trigger warning for somebody, like a content warning for you, I will urge you to understand that it is handled, and when the infant does pass away, it's done in a respectful manner, and it's not, like, in my opinion, it's not done in a way that disrespects the little life that did have that hour, if that makes sense. It doesn't just fade to black and it's done, you know, like it's explained, it's developed on. And the beautiful part about this book too, which is why I do cherish it so much, is that we get to see and hear and feel and experience how Mary's thoughts and internal monologue progress through the book. So we get those intimate details.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, again, like going back to the prose, I think like the way that her thoughts are written, and definitely as we get into spoilers, I'm going to read some quotes, but I think, yeah, like we learn so much about her, but also about the people around. Like, she's very good at telling us about the people around her, and even just learning the interactions, even if the interactions are limited. But I would agree that definitely, I think it is handled very well. I think it's handled very, like, it's not used for like shock value or like, you know, surprise, like drop in the middle of the book. It's very much built up. It feels very organic when it comes up.
Let's dive in.
So before we get into spoilers, we're going to take a very quick ad break. So listeners, please stay tuned and make sure you, or I guess if you don't, then go pick up the book, read it, and then immediately come back.
Nina's back here. I want to talk about this book forever.
Exactly. And hopefully you're hooked by now and you're like, oh, I got to go read this and come listen and get all the spoilers, which you should. All right. So join us after the break.
For the best in funk, soul, surf, and more music, tune in to Jack Velvet's Suburban Jungle Show, Wednesday mornings from 8 to 10 at CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Add us on Twitter at Jack Velvet Radio, Jack Velvet's Suburban Jungle Show. Also available streaming and podcast at jackvelvet.net.
Do you want to change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both! Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing healthcare, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder, because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Are you tired of Big Brother bookstores trying to sell you some billionaire's favorite book or Heather's top picks? Then you should check out Vancouver Books. Vancouver Books is a new online family-run bookstore. A portion of their profits go to First Nations reconciliation and environmental projects in British Columbia. They provide their customers with the most interesting books in fine arts, signed first editions, First Nations photography, fine ancient books, occult, and so much more. They also provide carbon-free delivery to anywhere in the Vancouver area. So go to www.vancouverbooks.ca to check out Vancouver Books today. That's www.vancouverbooks.ca.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Dog Ear Radio Book Club. I'm Randy, and I'm joined today by Bex. And we are talking about the book, Our Hideous Progeny, by C.E. McGill. And now is the time for spoilers. Yay!
It's time for the High Society Tea Party. We get to just give you all the tea, or the wine, depending on... if you want to spray it onto somebody's face.
For sure. So I want to cover just like the plot very generally right here. So if people are listening, they know kind of what we're talking about. So this is like a queer retelling or like reimagining. It's not even a retelling because it's a different story, but it's after Victor Frankenstein, his great niece, Mary. And so they... her and her husband are working to basically follow Victor's theories on, you know, bringing something back to life that was dead. But they decide to go the route of a sea creature, which I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. I'm going to be honest, I'm not a big Frankenstein fan. I've never actually been able to make it through the original Frankenstein. As much as I respect it, as like it has its time and place, and I get how impactful it was, I could not get into it. So I was so excited when they were like, Henry's like, are we going to bring back a person? I mean, he didn't say that, but he's like, what are we going to bring back? And she's like, goodness, no. And I was like, yes, thank you. Because I was like, I think just for me, it brings up too much ideas of like, you know, like the complexity of like the like bodies and, you know, mutilating bodies and things like that anyways. Sure. That I think this book did it so well by using this creature because it fed into this larger narrative of like Mary's history and her interest in, you know, sea creatures and life and how she got into science. And the person that introduced her to science. And so I think it was able to still deal with like the complexity of the original Frankenstein story, which is like life and death and the in-between and all of these different, you know, points. But I think in a way that I found a bit more approachable as a reader.
Yes. And what I will add to that is the really great undertone theme of this is how a partnership, so Mary and Henry, Mary knows something about herself is off. She understands that Henry is not necessarily her, let's call him soulmate. Okay. Like she knows something's, but in the time period, it is not okay to be a queer person and to be someone who, you know, pursues,
yeah,
you know, Maisie, I could talk for days and days about Maisie. I felt so seen with her character. She's a chronically ill darling girl. And C.E. McGill made me a little misty-eyed when the prose was explaining it was Maisie, and it was when she took them out to like the cliffs, and Maisie explains chronic illness like the weather, And I was like, oh my goodness, this is so wonderful, because it's like you're not some delicate thing that can be broken. It just simply means that some days are going to be not great days and some days are going to be really great ones. And there's representation there that I fear doesn't pop up enough. And this little book, this little morsel of a book, it has so much to it. And it has how financial can really upheave an unsteady relationship, because obviously Henry thinks that gambling away his money is the way to deal with his grief of his lost child, and how he's kind of like just a little bit of a waste of space. You love to hate him. And
I do.
Like, yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to hear your thoughts on him. The one more little thing that I wanted to add is like the little child in me who has always said when someone was like, what are you going to be when you grow up? I was always a paleontologist, because one, it was a cool word, and two, dinosaurs. So to be able to see a book with this impassioned, science forward, brilliant female main character who can hold her own, wanting to build a dinosaur, an aquatic dinosaur at that, a plesiosaurus, like, come on, yes. I was so excited. And I really think what I take away from it is that this is the story of how Nessie from the Loch Ness Monster came about. This is what I think this is what I think Mary was trying to do, and what C.E. McGill was leaning towards at the end, because obviously this book is a standalone. This book does have a finality to it, and the ending was beautiful, in my opinion. But it still made you wonder, well, what if, what happened to the creature, you know? And I think maybe, you know, it's still in a loch in Scotland, popping up sometimes like the Loch Ness Monster.
You know, I totally get that, because my first thought was like, oh my gosh, this creature is going to get out and it's going to like reproduce, and there's going to be all these like very cool like new sea creatures just like living their best life. So I think that's a great way to interpret the ending. I support that 100%.
It's just a little dreamer in me that just wants that to be real anyways. I want that to be real.
That's so fair. Yeah, I think so. You already mentioned this, but there is like this like I mean, the plot, and like we said, like, yes, this book is like about the creature and them, you know, bringing the creature to life, but it's actually like, that's like such a small portion. Like when I was reading my notes, I literally didn't have that much to say about it, because I was like, oh, they made this creature. And it was cool. But then I was like, oh my God, the characters. But also like the queerness. So like the underlying like queer plot line of this book, and so you mentioned this, like Mary is like, you know, something's off. And in the beginning of the book, she has this kind of like familiarity with Henry, right? They're very kind of like jovial together. Like they joke, they have a dark sense of humor, it appears, together. And throughout the book, that kind of becomes untethered. And so we get these flashbacks where Mary's reflecting on this girl that was her neighbor for a brief time, Catherine. Mm-hmm. And
with the, you know, beautiful accent. Like, it was so fun with the audiobook narrator. I highly recommend the audiobook.
Nice. Yeah, I read this. So I haven't listened to the audiobook. Sorry. Yeah.
No, that's okay.
And yeah, but I can totally see that. That would be awesome with the accent. But yeah, and so she's this, you know, very, and like, you can sort of, I mean, I adored this, because as, you know, I didn't come out as queer until I was over 18, and then I didn't come out as a lesbian until my 20s. But I remember reflecting of like finding my journal from when I was like 8, and it'd be like, I kissed my friend Ashley, and then I'd be like, oh my God, did you? Like, and so I think to me, like that little like confusion, like what Mary goes through, of like, you know, she's having this internal dialogue of how she feels about Catherine, but doesn't really get what it means. And then, you know, that moment of when she does kiss Catherine, and is essentially rejected, and like, you know, she never talks to her again, like that rejection, that feeling of like being rejected by someone that you hold in such high esteem. Like that was just, I mean, it was so sad, but it was so real. And yeah. And then we get like the adult relationship, where Mary's growing closer to Maisie. And I also thought that was like very beautiful and just so organic. And I think just also I appreciated how kind of like ambiguous it was. And yeah. I'm using the word ambiguous of like, it wasn't like, oh, she like fell in love with Maisie and now she's with Maisie. I think it made it much more like individual and like personal to Mary and to Maisie of what their relationship like, and it wasn't defined just like in concrete terms. I think that was beautiful.
I just basically say it's refreshing and it's wonderful to see that a lot of queer representing books are starting to showcase this, where they don't put it on a billboard and say, look at this lesbian or look at this queer person. You know, it's not spelled out to the reader, because love is not that subtle. Love is loud. Love is clear. But when we're feeling it, and it might not be a quote unquote appropriate, it feels awkward or it can feel out of place, and you don't know where to put those feelings because you don't have a rule book to follow. There's just cis male and cis female, and that's what we have to go forward in the 1850s, right? So
yeah,
to have anything outside that little box can feel like it's wrong. You know, and I think that was showcased beautifully, and the subtleties there, the subtleties in this book are so beautiful. And I know that when I, upon reread, we'll find more. But again, like I said earlier on, this is a book that's a wonderful stepping stone if you're wanting to get into more intricate vernaculars, intricate prose, intricate storylines. This doesn't feel forced. It's a very intelligent read.
Yeah, I will say that. Because when you said it was short, I was like, oh, this will be so quick for me to read. And then I was like, it took me like 8 hours to read it. And I was like, but this makes so much sense, because, you know, I would read a paragraph and then I would go back and reread it, because I feel like I want to reread this, because I feel like there's just like, if I miss one word, but it makes you want to do that. So it doesn't feel like overwhelming of like I often talk about Jane Austen, because, and I'm not a Jane Austen expert, so this isn't me making like some grand statement, but I do find her books very convoluted and confusing. And I get quite bored because I get very just like kind of overwhelmed by like how much, like, for example, imagery, you know, like she spends quite a lot of time describing like, you know, the weather or something. And I think this book strikes a very beautiful balance of like, you know, a lot of traditional fiction doesn't spend too much time, like contemporary anyways. I mean, I know this book isn't contemporary, but contemporary, like as in it's written now, but it's obviously based, it's historical fiction, but either way, but I think it strikes this beautiful balance of like, it's not overwhelming, but it still offers more than just like, you know, a lot of like standard fiction that I've read. That tends to spend more time on the dialogue, which I love, don't get me wrong, I love good dialogue, but I think this one strikes that very beautiful balance.
Yeah, I think it's echo that. I would say it's a very balanced book. It holds your hand in a way that isn't jarring, and it still leaves a little bit of mystery, which I love that. I don't want everything spelled out for me. But I want to enjoy the story. And just the fact that you said that you read it in 8 hours, like, Randy, what kind of robot are you? Like, are you kidding me? I wish I could read 400 pages in 8 hours. Like, wow. Tip my hat.
Oh, well, thank you. But I'm sure I'll owe it a reread in a few months to make sure that I got everything through. Yeah, okay, let's talk about Henry. I have to talk about Henry. I feel guilty, and this is a compliment to the author. Please, listeners, do not get this wrong. This is an absolute compliment to the author, because the way that C.E. McGill had me so focused on Henry, but also disliking him so much and being so frustrated that I was just like waiting to see what he would do next so that I could react to it. Like, I was so engaged, and it didn't take away from Mary's story. I was still so into that, but I'm just so impressed when authors can write characters that are so intriguing and so good to follow, but that you don't like. Because I think that like brings up the whole idea of like, only liking likable characters. And yeah, he had me going because he was so charming in the beginning. And I was like, I made a note being like, oh my gosh, these guys are like, I appreciate their dark humor and their relationship. Not recognizing that it was like a flag to what was going to happen. And then he just like, my gosh, it was like so subtle and so good. He just like, you know, slower and slower kept like letting me down as a reader. Like when Mary confronts him about what a scoundrel and what a bad person Finlay Clark is, his response is, well, my darling, all young men are scoundrels. And I was like, ugh, that's like that era's boys will be boys. And then I was like, oh man, Henry's like that era's nice guy, like quote unquote nice guy. If listeners know what I mean by that. And yeah, but he's just so like, so disappointed, but it's so realistic. I can't like, sorry, I'm at kind of a loss for words because I feel like,
he has this frustrative tension to him. And I think what was really expertly done in the story, though, is that he does to the reader what he did over time to Mary, you know, continuously let her down, continuously always was the one to devolve on those kind of things. And piggyback on her own successes because she was a woman and women aren't scientists in those times, and justifying the means of how other people treated her because that's how society was. And I think we do get glimpses of that in elements of like Pride and Prejudice and Bridgerton. Like we understand that high society have these, you know, these kind of standards that they adhere to and things like that. But what I loved about how Our Hideous Progeny handled it is this book has enough darkness to it that you can jump into those pools and you can hang out there for a minute and you can really absorb how that would feel and how that would make you feel as the reader and how that would make Mary feel how she was treated. And it justifies a lot of her actions. Now, would I call her a pinnacle of a, you know, protagonist? No. She has flaws. I think she has flaws too. And I love those flaws. I love how obsessive she can become and how, you know, frustrated she can be and how willing she is to put others out so that she can have her successes. But she's human, in my opinion. Like she would absolutely be someone who I could say I would meet for coffee and I would love to just chat her up and just see, you know, how's the creature doing? Like, I would love to do that. And I would love to like uninvite Henry at the last minute and tell him the wrong place so that he just shows up thinking he'll be in the right spot and he's in the wrong one.
Yeah, totally. I concur with that. And I think what stuck with me is the way that Henry is a character. I mean, because Finlay Clark is like very obvious, you know, like from the get-go, we know he's not good. He's the villain. We dislike him. Like, you know, he's pretty, like, don't get me wrong, he's a fantastic villain. I enjoyed reading him. But it's very obvious. And but the way that Henry is so subtle and like the way that you put it, like he's doing to us over the time of the book, what he did to Mary. And like, I like how it's not just like put to the reader as obvious, like Henry's bad. And therefore like she's in a bad relationship. She needs to leave. It's way more like human and way more complex. And also I think it transcends time. Like when I was reading Henry, I just, so much of what he did and what he said was like, this is what men do now. Like, this is like, you know, like this is not just like a strictly character, you know, a man of the mid 19th century. This is like that behavior, you know, that like speaking over people. Well, speaking of our women specifically, you know, taking credit for their success. And I won't get too into it, but I think there's a lot of parallels you can draw to conversations that we have nowadays about like, you know, labor and relationships and like equal relationships and all of these different conversations. But the one thing I did want to say is the way that he treated his sister absolutely to me was just like, that was like the biggest flag. Cause I like the way, like how dismissive he was of her. And this is the thing that hit me. Like he talks how much about he hates his father. Right. And he's estranged from his father and he doesn't like his father. But I think he becomes his father because it seems, mm-hmm. and we don't get his father's perspective, we don't get Henry's perspective, but it seems to me as a person who just finished this book that he becomes his father because he essentially treats Maisie in the same way that his father did, very dismissive, that she's wasting money, like not allowing her to take medicine that would actually help her to live a better life. And so anyway, this character fascinates me.
I love how it gets you going. I think that that's really wonderful. And that's a really great sign of good writing. How characters can make you feel things. And I 100% agree with you on every note. And what I would jump forward with is that Mary Shelley, when she wrote Frankenstein in the 1800s, like she did a republish of Frankenstein in 1831. So when we're thinking about this book, it's only like 20 years after Mary Shelley would have made Frankenstein. And what is really fascinating about that is the message of Frankenstein. Now I understand that you didn't quite finish it, and that is completely okay. Like there's Wikipedia for a reason. It's all good. But a great takeaway for me from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is that you evolve or you repeat. That is a very simplistic, very, very, very simple breakdown. And I feel like that is also reflected in Our Hideous Progeny too, because it's kind of like Henry just falls back into these generational cycles. Not necessarily just men. Anybody can do that, right? We can fall mm-hmm. back into the flaws and the wonderful things that we get from our generation before us. But Henry kind of just gets stuck in the fog and he does that repetitive cycle. And I completely agree with you that he does turn into his father by the end. And I got to say the fist pump moment for me where I was like, hell yeah, was when the boathouse was burning because Clark had sabotaged it and taken the creature and Mary was like, oh my gosh, like, what do we do? Like, everything is just the creature. Oh my gosh. And she's like obsessing over her creation, who, you know, she has a sort of love for, but also just mine. And then we've got Henry, who's like, that's my bread and butter. Like, what the H? And then we've got Maisie Tokyo drifting in on her cart and being like, come on, guys, get in my cart. Like, let's go. And she's like this very, very ill person who probably shouldn't be doing this big of an adventure, but she's like, F it all. Let's go get this thing. And it was an empowering moment and it was so great. And it just makes you love those characters so much more because Henry's mm-hmm. just sitting there like, oh, these ladies are just saving my life yet again. Like, okay, I guess I'll join, you know? So it's just like believable, but also a great representation of how, like, if we don't now you don't have to evolve to a point of like going against the morals of science and reanimate dead things kind of thing, but you have to advance to progress, you know, you have to keep evolving or you get stuck with where you are. And Henry refused to evolve, and that's kind of a little bit of a take, which I really did appreciate. And it, you know, it makes you a little bit sad, but it also makes you go, huh, because this book, I found, although it be, you know, a 200-ish years ago, it makes you think about today and how today's world is. And it makes you question the scientific moral grounds, but also just the humanity that is now. Are we similar? And I would say that there's still a lot of parallels.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's so beautifully put. And thank you, Bex. I think that's such a beautiful takeaway from the book, that like, it truly is about like, you know, getting out of these. And I think that's why I love the ending so much. So for the ending of the book, she frees the creature and then she leaves Henry and goes back to her name, so Mary Frankenstein. And she goes on this adventure with Maisie. And I think that that is just like it's such a beautiful ending, because it's not like, it's not a, you know, straightforward happily ever after, but it's a, I don't know, I'm trying to think of like a fun term, but either way, it's a very good ending that like leaves you still feeling like very like warm inside.
Well, I think it offers that inclusivity and that representation that this whole book has been building up to, where mm-hmm. it might not necessarily be the happy ending that everybody wanted, but it's a happy ending that allows for a new beginning to happen. And those are the best endings anyways, you know? And it's like these gothic gays get to love each other and be subtle and be sweet and fun and bubbly. And also, I just love Mary's little jab a little bit to Catherine, where she goes, what was it? There was a part near the end where she goes, well, we have somewhere to stay in Paris if we need to go there. Basically being like, I'm just going to invite myself to Catherine's because she owes me. and I can show off my girlfriend that never happened with that kind of thing. Like, it was just such a fun little jab. And I love Mary's spunk. And I think another wonderful thing, and I know that we're probably getting tight on time here, but very rarely do I read author's notes and find connection to them. Yeah. And honestly, this book has a beautiful author's note. And I love how C.E. McGill took the time to kind of explain how this story came about. And like that last line in their author's note, which says, "We shall be monsters, you and I." Like, yes, yes, like snaps, snaps for that. Like, I took a picture of this last little bit of the author's note and I sent it to a friend. And I was like, "You need to read this book because this is the author's note alone." And she was like, "Oh my gosh, I am downloading this now." And she actually read it this past week. So I can't wait for her to hear this episode.
That's so fantastic.
Yeah. I want so many people to read this book. And I know that it's Pride Month, which is absolutely wonderful. But honestly, Pride is all year. So this book is a perfect one for Pride Month, though, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah. Definitely better than watching a Hollywood period piece.
I would agree with you.
Lesbians. I would, don't watch those, read this. Mm-hmm. We are unfortunately coming to the end of time, which, oh my gosh, I could talk about this book for so long.
I'm so glad you liked it, Randy. That makes my heart sing. I'm so excited about that.
Yeah, it was an absolute fantastic recommendation. And I just, you know, the season, right, is Summer of Love, and obviously I love romance, but I also love reading books that people love. I think you learn so much about the person, and it's just so great to share something that you love. And I'm always here for that. So thank you so much for the suggestion, Bex. Thank you so much.
I think that there's so many different facets of love, and honestly, I love a good romance novel. I think that this also shows the darker sides of love, where grief mm-hmm. is love with nowhere to go kind of thing. And that in this book really, it expands on that. And it shows how obsession can be akin to love, but isn't truly. And just the ways that love can intertwine and find people, and that love is love. It doesn't have to be the package that you love. It's the insides, and that's the ending of the book, and I adore that.
I do as well. So thank you so much for coming on the show. Thanks for this recommendation. So where can all of the listeners find you and follow you?
Well, you're so welcome. I'm so grateful to be here, and you all can find me. I'm usually accessible on Instagram. Bex.hexandrex is my handle. I'm on Goodreads. I have a link tree on there. I am working on writing my own little sapphic sci-fi. It does have some more high-tech stuff. So once it's done, Randy, I'll walk you through that. But I hope you enjoy that when it comes around time. But Instagram somewhere you can find me. And I'll leave it there. That's fine. You want to find me, that's where I am.
Awesome. Well, thank you to the listeners, and we'll see you next time.